Hello and welcome to episode 25 of the Structure and Interpretation of Computer Programmers podcast. Once again, a bored man has got access to a microphone and will use it to be wrong on the internet. I am that man, my name is Graham Lee. I mentioned in an earlier episode that I was starting a PhD on software engineering and that would motivate a lot of the topics for episodes of this podcast. And this episode is one of those. Because what I'm doing the PhD on is the sort of practice and values of research software engineering. And, you know, I've got a sort of vague idea that in 3 or so years' time, what I'll basically come up with is a manifesto, if you like, for how software should be written in a research context. And that means a couple of things. One is that I'm going to need to gather data on how software is currently being written in a research context, and also on what problems are encountered with writing software in a research context. And it also means I'm going to have to convince a lot of people who work in research that the proposals made in this manifesto are actually valid. So I'm kind of looking forward to the end of this research project here and asking what has been tried in this domain, in the area of sort of data-driven or theory-based approaches to improving software practices. And of course, as you probably know by now, having listened to the episodes, the answer is going to be not much, but the time taken to deliver this answer is going to be quite great and is going to go through a lot of different areas. So that is what's going to happen now. I'm going to show you that there is not much theory in software engineering. So I've kind of divided the history of the software world into a few waves, and the first wave is what I'm going to call software engineering with like capital S and E. That's the thing that arguably started in the Garmisch conference in 68, the NATO conference on software engineering. Arguably already existed, but just wasn't given a name yet, and arguably wasn't actually created at that point at all. But everybody likes to believe that what they were doing now had a name and a brand and a reason for being funded. Nonetheless, the thing that kind of crystallized in 1968 and lasted like definitely through the 80s and the 90s and into the 2000s and was particularly popular and well written about in the 80s and the 90s with the rise of commercial object-oriented programming. Now, what software engineering did was it didn't have an underlying theory of software creation. It borrowed its theory from other engineering practices, particularly industrial engineering, military engineering, civil engineering, those sorts of things. Without necessarily understanding whether they applied to software, the idea was typically, this is how we do these other projects. We're going to do this project in the same way. Often the people who were delivering software, particularly at the beginning of that very long phase of the software engineering wave, were doing so as an adjunct to hardware. Like, you know, you had an IBM computer and there was some value add in having a PL1 compiler. So the compiler was effectively part of the hardware in a way, in that it was part of that product and was shipped with the same product. So you had these people who were used to electrical engineering, hardware engineering, or in the case of military, then like, you know, hardware engineering, bridge building, whatever, project management, and would just say, we need to manage this other part of this project, therefore these project managers are going to do the same thing over here. So software creation was treated as a project management problem, with programming being a little cog in the machine. If you got the upstream bits right, so if you got the requirements correct and you got the specification correct and they had all been signed off by the managers and, you know, agreed as the things that needed to be happening, then your software engineers, your programmers could turn a handle and the correct software would come out. And, you know, a lot of software has been delivered that way. If you look at, for example, the IBM wrote the second generation of the software that does ATM, like, sort of balance counting in the UK. So, like, if you imagine every bank has its cash machines, and they will all vend cash to people who, you know, who put their card in and authenticate and request cash, and like, what you don't do is sort of like, if someone comes up to a Lloyd's TSB cash machine with a Barclay card and gets cash out, you don't just send Barclays a money order for however much cash they request. What happens is, at the end of the day, all of the who owes what to which bank is totaled and tallied, and then, you know, the difference is subtracted, and then it's settled. So, like, you know, maybe Barclay card customers withdrew £1.6 million from Lloyd's TSB ATMs, but Lloyd's TSB customers extracted £1.5 million from Barclays ATMs. Therefore, there's £100,000 that needs to be paid. And that's, yeah, that's sort of settled daily. And I think this software is called Kix. Now, this software was written in Java and replacing a mainframe application that had been written in COBOL. So, you know, the behavior was very well specified. It needs to do exactly what the COBOL mainframe software does, nothing different whatsoever. If there is any diversion from that behavior, then it has failed. So, you know, very easy to precisely define the specification of the behavior. You can also define the performance. You know, the software is going to run in this window and is going to produce its results within these times, and is going to, like, you know, require this much time to take the data from the various banks, and has this much time to push the you know, payment requests out to the various banks, and it's going to run on whatever hardware we need, and so on. What they then did was built, using sort of formal methods techniques, models that demonstrated that if there was software that implemented the modeled behavior, then it would correctly conform to the specification. And that took a couple of years. And then they wrote a tool that generated Java code from the model, and that took a few months. And then they generated the software. So actually, the bit where you write the working software was a very small part of a like multi-year project. And it works successfully. And this is something that it's important to remember about that first wave of software engineering, is that a lot of software came out of it and worked, or worked well enough to you know, to still have life today. Like, all of Microsoft's major products, apart from the Xbox, come from that time, and of course bits of the Xbox do as well, the Windows NT kernel and bits of the operating system. Like the banking infrastructure, the railways infrastructure, like British Waterways, who run the canals, have been computerized since like the 70s or 80s. They were all using these software engineering methodologies to do it. It can work. It often failed. It often, you know, cost surprising amounts of money. It was often very frustrating that you'd go like years without seeing any working software. But nonetheless, it could work. The observable outcome is that it could also fail, and that a lot of these failures were significant or even epic. And the argument could definitely be made that the underlying theory was insufficient because it wasn't a theory of software engineering. It was the theory of other types of engineering that was translated to software. But an engineering theory should be based on a sort of combination of science and human factors and aesthetics, and the human factors and aesthetics and the science of software are all very different from construction efforts. So it's no surprise that an engineering methodology taken from those fields would not apply to software. So the first reaction to this was the sort of lightweight methods that became certainly large minority activities in the 90s. Things like rapid application development and Crystal and DSDM, and then like coalesced around the publication of the Agile Manifesto, and then you know, things like lean programming as well. So I'm drawing a very long 1990s here and calling this first wave Agile, because while it definitely predates Agile, the Agile Manifesto and the ideas in it came out of this movement rather than the techniques in this movement coming out of a search for an implementation of the Agile Manifesto. So first wave Agile, 90s into the 2000s. And this first wave like recommended a lot of practices, and typically they would come bundled as a methodology. And so there were these sort of, you know, blessed priests who were the methodologists, who were the people who were allowed to tell you how to do software, and you did the practices that they suggested. You know, you would take your copy of Extreme Programming Explained and you would read about the 14 pillars of XP, and then you would do those things. Or like Alistair Coburn would tell you how Crystal worked, and then you would implement that. And so it was very much sort of solution driven. Here are the things you should be doing. And there was a bit of a sort of redressing away from this sort of Taylorian management science, saying that like a software team is a bunch of professionals who are doing a professional job, and one that leads to the design and implementation of a successful software project. Not they are like workers inside a machine that is turning requirements into working software. But again, it was borrowed theory. It was largely from outside the traditional manufacturing, or at least the traditional Western manufacturing ideology, because things like Lean and Kanban and theory of constraints are very much from automotive engineering, but they are from a Japanese way of doing automotive engineering, rather than from an American way of doing it. And of course, like all of the engineering companies, all the people who are making cars, also saw value in these methodologies and adopted them. So like, you know, GM, Chrysler, Austin Rover in the UK, all started doing Kanban after they saw how quickly and efficiently Japanese automotive companies could successfully make working vehicles. So, you know, maybe it's a better engineering methodology than the one from like Western Taylorian management science that became the first like software engineering idea. But it's still definitely an external methodology. It's not about the production of software. But the reasons that the people were suggesting that it should be applied to the production of software largely came not from their presentations of the underlying theory, but from their presentations of their own success and their own authority. You know, remember that the opening sentence of the Agile Manifesto talks about the fact that we've been uncovering better ways of making software by doing it and by helping others to do it. So it's like, we, you know, we've worked out how this works. Now you get to share in our benefits. Nonetheless, using these theories that come from outside. So, you know, the Poppendykes promoting lean software. The DevOps movement, which I'm putting into this first wave of Agile as a kind of late resurgence, because I think of the DevOps principles as being a restatement of the Agile Manifesto for people who have either burnt out on Agile or who learned the wrong things from the Agile transition. And when I talk about, you know, the wrong things, I mean what the presenters of DevOps think of as the wrong things. You know, there's a correlation of project management or work management and technical practices in extreme programming, and so there is in DevOps. You know, DevOps has sort of continuous delivery and the idea of teams providing services to other teams as a basis, and it, you know, is, I think, a sort of modern retelling of Agile. But it's also very evident that it is a modern borrowing of an external management theory of engineering into software engineering. You know, the Phoenix Project, the book that describes how a successful DevOps transition can work, is an incredibly light touch rewriting of Eliyahu Goldratt's book, The Goal, which is about the theory of constraints, which is his presentation to Western management scientists and managers of these sort of Japanese approaches to management that came from like the automotive world. So once again, we have a thing that doesn't have an underlying theory of software, but we can infer something about what its theory would be. And I think the theory of first wave Agile, one factor of it is a rejection of the sort of Taylorian management science approach. Yeah, we're going away from this idea that if you sit at the top of the waterfall and you get your trajectory correct, then you'll land at the bottom of the waterfall safely. A software team is a self-organizing team, and therefore it doesn't need no stinking management. You know, it's a group of experts who can expertly come together and create software. Another like part of it is that while there's like less of a reliance on the work management being done as a sort of external driver of the team, there is still these two parts to society. There's still the Morlock and the Eloi, but the Morlock and the Eloi are the team with the sort of inverted square quotes around it. They're the people who make the software, and the business with more square quotes. The business are the goal donors, the people who produce the motivation for the software, the requirements, and they are the gold owners, they are the sponsors of the software, and the team takes those requirements and that money and turns it into working software. They should work closely together, but there's still this kind of you know, class distinction between the people on the team. Or like, you know, the technical and the non-technical. You'll often hear someone in a software group say, because, you know, technical is kind of seen as better than non-technical, because otherwise, you know, you would like mention what the skills that the people outside the software team have. You wouldn't just call them non-technical. They may be very technical. They may be patent lawyers. They may be, you know, financial advisors. They may be biochemical researchers or pharmaceutical experts, but they're non-technical in that they don't produce software. So we still have this kind of butting of two groups of people who have different needs, and you hope that the needs are aligned. You hope that, you know, if the business wants to make money by succeeding in a particular endeavor, and the software team wants to deliver working software that will enable that endeavor or add value to it, then those two things will be pointing in the right direction. But there's always the chance that it won't, because, you know, my goal as a software person is not to advance that business. It is to produce working software, even if the production of working software isn't exactly what that business needs at the moment. Also, in a academic context, you know, we're going to have trouble with mapping this idea of the business onto research teams. So that was first wave Agile, which suggests that there are later waves of Agile. And I'm going to draw my dividing line between the first wave, which was all of those sort of lightweight methods that birthed the Agile Manifesto, and that, you know, kind of saw it rise as a countervailing force to the traditional approach to software engineering. With the second wave of Agile, which I'm going to call the second wave of Agile Scrum and Scrumbut, but I appreciate that Scrum already existed around the time of the Agile Manifesto. That, yeah, as far as Agile goes, Scrum is a very early methodology. But I think there was a sea change in the way that people thought about, like, the capital A word Agile, from things like XP to things like Scrum. But when I say things like Scrum, I basically mean almost 100% Scrum. And I think that this shift in mindset and the rising popularity of Scrum as the way that Agile is practiced inside an organization that has gone through an Agile transition can be linked to a document called the Project Manager's Declaration of Interdependence, which I think was written around 2005, was at pmdoi.org, was on Alistair Coben's website. Those have been taken down, so I'm going to link in the show notes to the Wayback Machine, because, you know, it's better to look at these first sources than anything else I could find, which were selective quotes from it. Now, these used the same sort of principles, you know, the same ideas that arise in the Agile Manifesto, but ask the question, how do we do this as project managers? Which is an interesting thing, because, like, the first wave of Agile was kind of saying, we've got this self-organizing team. And then the PMDOI is saying, how do we impose order onto this team? You know, how do we get what we want out of this team who thinks that they're self-organizing and can work out what they're supposed to be doing themselves? And, you know, Scrum is, like, you know, presented as a collaborative framework, but definitely does elevate certain roles in the decision-making process. Whether that's the way that it was intended, I'm not so sure, but it certainly is the way that it is practiced and the way I've commonly seen it done. And so that's why I include Scrumbut in the second wave. This idea that if you take your Scrum and then tweak it to make it, like, politically acceptable within your organization, then you are successfully doing Agile software development. So Scrum is basically a framework for improving work management. It is based around the idea of a long-term initiative focused on producing a commercially valuable product. You know, so, like, the idea that you have sprints and a backlog and you reprioritize the backlog every sprint suggests that you are going to be doing multiple sprints, and that your list of priorities will, you know, have some sort of, like, permanent lag in it. You know, you will never be done. That there will always be other things to do, and the only question is, which of these things should we do next? Now, it happens that the product to which the Scrum framework for process management is applied is often software, but there are no technical practices. It's entirely about how you organize the effort of your team, the reporting of that team, the measurement of that team's success, and the ongoing improvement of that team. And, you know, I could be talking about the elves making the Christmas presents in Lapland, or I could be talking about Toyota making cars. It happens that I'm probably talking about a software team, but there's nothing in Scrum itself to suggest that the thing being produced is software. So what happened to all of the technical practices that went into making software, you know, that were so important in the first wave of Agile? Well, according to what I'm going to put as, you know, one of the key books in the second wave of Agile, which is Steve McConnell's 2019 book, More Effective Agile, those technical practices never demonstrated their utility in the real world. And so there's no need to go into them. And that, that kind of seems a bit like intellectually weak. Maybe those practices didn't demonstrate themselves in the real world, but other ones have. Or maybe no software engineering practice has ever demonstrated its value, and therefore we need to do more work. But just saying we should ignore these practices that were in this Kent Beck book because you can write software without them, and the people who have been writing software with them haven't done a significantly better job, seems like a sort of intellectual shortcut has happened somewhere there. Maybe McConnell, being a sort of survivor of the software engineering school from before the first wave, is just sour that Agile won, and so he wants to do the Scrum thing because that's how you get consultancy gigs these days. You can't do it by saying you're a old school software engineering head. But maybe he's a bit bitter on it, and so he just does. We'll only take the bits he likes. That's again a cynical take. I'm not seriously suggesting that, but I am suggesting that there is a hole in the reasoning here, and Scrum is full of holes. Like, because it doesn't talk about technical practices, it just has gaps in which we embed our technical practices. If we are using Scrum to make a software product, then in between all of the ceremonies that Scrum makes us do, we have to write some software, and that's where the software practices go. There's a velocity at which user stories get turned into accepted software, and there's an invitation in the retrospective to reflect on how our process is working at turning user stories into accepted software and to enact improvements in those processes. But there's nothing about those processes themselves. There's nothing about how we measure them, how we know whether they're succeeding or holding us back, whether we should do more of a particular process or drop another process or improve the way at which we do practice. And that is why Scrum is such a hard methodology to use correctly, and that's why Scrum Butt is so common in our industry. It's a process management framework, a process improvement framework that doesn't actually tell us anything about the process that we're managing or improving. It says, okay, well, here's your time boxed meeting at which you make your process better. Great, what is my process and what is it trying to do and why is it not doing better? What do I need to do to it? Scrum is silent on these things, and that is why there's a lot of consultancy money in running retrospectives. The money is not in running retrospectives. The money is in identifying what the problems are on the team and addressing them, because Scrum definitely ain't going to do that for you. Now, just as I added DevOps to the first wave of Agile, I'm going to add the Software Engineering Institute's CMMI, that's the Capability and Maturity Model integration, to the second wave of Agile. Even though CMMI actually comes from CMM, which is a sort of old school software engineering pre-Agile way of thinking about things. And my reason is that CMMI is all about process and process improvement. You can kind of think of it as like the ISO 9000 of the software world. If you have a documented process and you have instituted that all of your software engineering effort follows this process, and you are gaining metrics and feedback on this process, and you're using those metrics to inform process improvements, all of the things that Scrum tells you to do and doesn't tell you how to do, then you are at level 5 on the CMMI. But CMMI also doesn't tell you how to do those things. It just tells you that you should be doing them. So I'm kind of going to bundle CMMI into that second wave Agile Scrum Butt way of writing software. Now, of course, the Software Engineering Institute also have the personal software process and the team software process, which are tools that programmers and groups of programmers can use to understand their practices and improve on their practices. But just as the CMMI tells you how to do process improvement without telling you how the practices link to the process improvement, so SEI, sorry, so PSP and TSP tell you about practices and practice improvement, but don't link them to the processes. So they don't, yeah, you know, you've got these two separate things that aren't glued together in a sort of unifying model. And we're going to come back to this idea of a unifying model at the end of the episode. But before that, I need to cover the third wave, which never really got traction. You know, there's a lot of vocal proponents, but it has not replaced the second wave. I would suggest that the loud money and the lion's share of the loud money in software engineering now is in that second wave agile. It's in the Scrum and Scrumbut. I would say that the rest, almost all of the rest of the money in software is in the zeroth wave, is in the traditional software engineering approach, or cowboy programming, which is really unfair to cowboys who did, you know, sort of work collaboratively in teams and had defined processes for like herding cattle. You know, they were like farm hands. They weren't frontiers people. They weren't lawless at all. So I apologize to any 18th century US cowboys who are listening to the podcast. But you know, I would say that if you drew a pie chart of where all of the effort in software engineering that is done for money is done by share of money, you'd probably find a surprisingly large amount of it is in the zeroth school, traditional software engineering. Then the lion's share of everything else is second wave. And whether or not the zeroth wave or the second wave is the largest, I'm not entirely sure. It may well be that the second wave is. It may just be that those are the kinds of organisations that I have worked with and worked for over my career. So everyone is largely doing either traditional, like, you know, what you might call waterfall or modified waterfall or spiral method or something like that, software engineering, or they are doing Scrum or Scrumbut. And they might be failing at either of those things, but they are, you know, what they are trying to do is one of those things. Then very few people are doing first wave. There are people who are, absolutely swear by it, and they are probably people who sort of grew up through that first wave. So, you know, people who worked at or with companies like Object Mentor or Tektronix, or, you know, the sort of small talk people from you know, from the birth of object-oriented programming as a commercial endeavor. I would say that a tiny number of software people and a large number of software consultants who are loud on Twitter are in this third wave, which definitely has not displaced and does not look like it is going to displace the second wave, which is what I'm going to call the agilier-than-thou wave. So this is the post-agile software complex. Software craftsmanship, clean code, programming motherfucker. These completely reject the idea of, you know, process and of management and of, like, you know, external interference. You are a professional programmer. Your job is to write software. Shut up. Stop what you're doing now. Write software. Do the software in the way that I, the loud person with the Twitter account, have deemed to be the correct way to write software. You should do more unit tests and more refactoring, because that's how professionals write software. Now, there's no theory underlying that. There's just me with my big gob telling you that that's what you need to do. That's what the professionals do. That's what it is your ethical imperative to do. Software Craftsmanship, The New Imperative, was the title of Pete McGreen's book. So, you know, let's link some of these things together. Like, actually, if I push and I say, well, hold on, like, you want me to do unit tests and refactoring because you want me to do unit tests and refactoring, that's a bit unsatisfactory, then, you know, there will be a discussion behind that, and it will be a discussion that has merit. You know, we want you to do unit tests and refactoring because companies that don't do unit tests and refactoring quickly build up technical debt and legacy code and find themselves incapable of moving forwards because they are incredibly slow or infinitesimally slow at adding to their existing software because it takes so long to understand and to reduce the risk of making changes to an acceptable level. Okay, great. So you want me to do unit tests and refactoring. How much? Where's my measure of how much this tech debt is slowing me down? Where is the dial that shows me what opportunity cost I would lose if I worked on reducing this technical debt? Or what capability or performance I would gain by increasing this technical debt? And where is my metric that shows me where this thermostat should be and where the dial currently is, and how do I move this dial to the correct level on the thermostat? How do I correctly balance the idea that my company can't do anything because we didn't do enough at reducing the technical debt, and the idea that my company can't do anything because everyone's busy adopting new tools or rewriting existing code? Like, where is the balance in between this? Where's the theory underpinning this choice to focus on these technical practices? So we have re-foregrounded the technical practices now. You know, the post-Agile wave is all about getting better at the craft, as it's called, of programming, but without like telling you how better you need to be or how where good enough is or when to stop doing that. And you know, we'll be told, well, be pragmatic, or we'll be told choose the best tool for the job. Both of which are weak source arguments, because we can not know what the pragmatic decision is unless we understand what process we're trying to achieve, what goal we're trying to get to. Like, the idea of pragma relates to a fact, and if you're not telling me what the facts are, then I don't know how to proceed. Or another translation of pragma would be deed. But I need to know how what I am about to do is going to translate into accomplishments before I can make a pragmatic choice. Dogma is a useful thing because it's grounded in a definition and an explanation. That's why dogmatism is so useful. You can always understand where the backing is for an idea, but of course that backing may be purely dogmatic. It may be purely this is what people say to do. Well, it turns out if some loud person on the internet with Twitter is saying you should write unit tests because it is the ethically responsible thing to do without giving you any justification, that's actually dogmatism. That's not pragmatism. So the third wave, again, putting my cynical hat on, I note that the principal authors behind the third wave movements, not so much Pete McBreen, but the people who came after him, are the sort of alpha male programmers who train programmers and consult for programmer teams and need to be seen as the best programmers, as the master craftsmen, in order to keep that vision alive. And so maybe it's no surprise that what they want you to do is to program harder in order to succeed as programming. Once again, I'm not suggesting that that is actually the thought processes these people have, but that's certainly an interpretation that springs to mind when I think about being told what the pragmatic choice is by someone who is only giving me a single option and is only expecting me to dogmatically follow it. Or someone who tells me that this is the best tool for the job, but who can't give me an explanation or a rationale for which other tools they've considered and why none of those was as good at all for the job, or even can't necessarily tell me what the job is. Okay, those are my four waves, and I've said I would come back to the idea of connecting the practices with the processes. You know, my complaint about the SEI was you have PSP and TSP for making the practices better, and you have CMMI for making the processes better, but like these things interact with each other, and we actually, you know, it would be useful to have something that improved our capability holistically, where we knew how the practices were going to affect the processes and how the processes are going to affect the practices and how each of those helps us achieve our goals. I don't know of a solution. What I do know of is an honest attempt to create a solution called SEMAT. That's S-E-M-A-T. Software Engineering Method and Theory. The three people who are sort of the driving creators behind this are Ivar Jacobsen. Now, Ivar Jacobsen is someone whose name would be familiar from the Zeroth Wave, particularly the sort of object-oriented phase of the Zeroth Wave of software engineering. You know, if you wanted to understand how use cases could be used with the UML to help you understand the requirements of your software and help you design your object-oriented solution, then Ivar Jacobsen is one of the people you would turn to. Bertrand Meyer, who, as far as I'm concerned, is Bertrand Meyer, and we could stop there, but, you know, just a quick summary for everybody else. He, again, from that Zeroth Wave of object-oriented software engineering, creator of the Eiffel language, so kind of trying to apply some of the ideas from formal methods into the specification of object-oriented programs using contracts. So the idea that your program could contain an executable version of the specification that would cause the program to fail if it ever deviated from the expected and designed behavior. But, you know, also a sort of thinker more generally about object-oriented programming. If you have ever heard of the SOLID principles, then the open-closed principle comes from Meyer's book, Object-Oriented Software Construction. And then Richard Soley, who is the current CEO, I think chairman maybe, of the Object Management Group, which was, again, from that sort of first wave, from the Zeroth Wave, rather, the object-oriented software engineering wave. They were a group who, you know, started out trying to build an implementable but also shared specification for distributed objects and move more broadly into sort of standardization focused on interoperability of object-oriented engineering techniques, and have, you know, come up with or integrated with various processes for business process notation, software requirements documentation, but also technical standards around things like remote procedure invocation and the like. So there's this group of people who have created this thing called SEMAT. And what SEMAT does is, well, what SEMAT claims to do is much grander than what it actually does. I'm going to start with that preface. So the thing that it has produced is called the essence, and part of the essence is a thing called the kernel. And what these do is to associate the main features of a software engineering activity with the practices that support that activity. So we've got this link between the processes and the practices, because the process, the work management, the way of working, is one of the dimensions in the SEMAT. You've got the stakeholders, the opportunity, so that would be like a business opportunity or maybe a research goal or, you know, whatever it is that you're trying to achieve or have identified it would be valuable to achieve. You've got the requirements, you've got the software system, the team, the way of working, and the work. And these seven things are all interrelated. So it's very much a sort of systems thinking approach to software engineering, where you say, we know that these things interact with each other. And we also know that any of the things that we might want to do as software engineers, any of the practices that we might want to institute, are going to have an effect on one or more of these dimensions. Now, they're called alphas for reasons that look like they used to have something to do with an acronym that has got lost, but you know, whatever. They're called alphas, these seven different dimensions of a software endeavor. And as I said, they're connected. So, you know, we know that the requirements are there because the stakeholders have identified an opportunity and believe that these requirements help to exploit that opportunity. And we know that the requirements are going to affect the software system, because the software system should fundamentally be an implementation of the requirements. But what that tells us is that if we've got very good practices and processes for turning requirements into working software, that don't mean a thing if we haven't got the correct stakeholders identifying a genuinely valuable opportunity and using that knowledge in order to express the requirements effectively. So yeah, we see how the feedback loops in this system can enable or hold back our success in software. And the value in a systems thinking approach is that we can acknowledge, and the SEMAT group definitely do acknowledge, that we don't have an underlying theory of software engineering, but that nonetheless we can use our ideas of cybernetics and of control theory and of like how systems work to build measurable models of the system that we have. Their suggestion is that, you know, so each of these dimensions, these alphas, goes through various stages from, and they're all vaguely along the lines of like, we have barely defined this thing, we've got a vague understanding of what this thing is, we've got a good understanding of what this thing is, we are capable of actioning this thing, we are no longer interested in this thing. And you know, I have definitely like vastly paraphrased that, but you could imagine how that applies to requirements, to ways of working, to teams. You know, your team starts off, it has a collection of individuals, and then you know, goes through that old forming, storming, norming, and performing model, and then finally gets disbanded and, you know, off to something else. But it's the same sort of progression applies there. And so they say that, you know, while we know we don't have a good theory, what we do know is that these practices will affect this system, and we can observe and react to and control how the practices affect the system, and then we'll be able to derive a model of how software engineering works by knowing how this system works. And that is very good for me as, you know, both as like a PhD student who needs to have a compelling argument behind his thesis, but also as a as someone who's trying to recommend interventions in software engineering to people who are, you know, looking for a quality argument backing those interventions, because it is open to both quantitative and qualitative inputs. You know, I can say, right, it looks like this this aspect, this alpha in the SEMAT, is not at a very good level of maturity. Now let me go and gather some data to show why that is. Or, you know, maybe I can say, like, it doesn't look like this team is performing particularly well. Let me go and interview the people on the team and see what they think about it, and see what they think their strengths and weaknesses and the way they work together is. So, you know, combine sort of like statistical data about the way that the software is being made and the outcomes, and then more sort of social science informed ideas or facts about what the people are doing and why they're doing it, to build a model that then has a causative effect on the production of the software. And that is exactly the kind of thing I need in order to produce a successful intervention that would work for people with a sort of, you know, scientific or more generally a research or academic mindset. So that's all good. Yeah, we can acknowledge that there isn't a theory of software that underpins everything, while also saying we shouldn't just like think of a theory of software and then like, you know, do that in vacuo and come up with some practices that are motivated by this theory that we just like brained out of nothing. That's a sort of very Aristotelian approach to to just thinking hard and then realizing women have fewer teeth than men, which isn't true but was thought at the time because someone thought it, and if you think it, it's probably true. No, that's not how we do things anymore. We have this more sort of Popperian approach where something is true or could be true until you have demonstrated evidence to the contrary, but it must be proved. You know, a valuable statement is one that can be tested and found either consistent or inconsistent with what we see. Now, I've moved very much from a sort of relativist approach where I'm saying I need, you know, qualitative information. I need to be able to see what people think of these ideas, and you know, and see what the different interpretations are and how these interpretations affect the system, to a positivist one where I'm saying there is a statement that can be like verified or falsified. That is deliberate, and I'm aware I'm doing it. I'm doing it because a lot of the people who are involved in research software are actually scientists. And so, you know, these people have a logically positivist outlook. And so any argument that is made has to convince those people that it has validity. But the thing that makes SAMAP bad from my perspective is like the fact that while there is no theoretical basis, they're kind of going out and saying that, you know, there must be a general theory of software engineering. Let's work out what it is. And so they've sponsored, at least to my knowledge, 4 workshops on GTSE, the general theory of software engineering. And I don't think there is, and I'm not convinced that there can be a general theory of software engineering. If there is one, I don't think we're anywhere near close to it. And my reason is that software is a crystallized intellectual process. You know, this is something that Alan Turing worked out. Actually, it's something that Charles Babbage worked out. That a computer program is a procedure of instructions that can be followed by a person with a pencil and paper equally well as a computer. A computer might do it more reliably, it might do it quicker, but you know, nothing stops you taking a computer program and a big piece of paper and writing out all of the values and rubbing them out and updating them when you, you know, execute each instruction and going through it in your head. It is a thought process. We don't have a general theory of thought. We have logic, which expresses the little bit. Let's go back to our paradigms for a moment. Logic is very good at that sort of, well, logical positivist view of the world. Like if there is a truth, and if there are certain things that follow from other things, logic will help us to understand what the things are that follow. So logic can help us generate the computer program that we want, or it can help us to understand the implications of the computer program that we have. However, it cannot tell us whether that was the right computer program, because logic doesn't tell us whether we chose the correct opportunity. Logic doesn't tell us whether our team will work together well. Logic doesn't tell us whether we've got the right stakeholders in the room. So logic is incomplete as a tool for designing and implementing thought processes. Software is an implementation of a thought process. We don't have a general theory for implementing thought processes. We don't have a general theory for thought processes at all, really. And therefore, without a general theory of thought, software engineering being a crystallization of thought, we don't have a general theory of software engineering, and we're nowhere near it. As ever, I would love to have your feedback on this episode. You can email me, grahamlee@acm.org. Thank you very much for listening. I hope you're doing well, and we will talk again soon.